Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would it take for you to get up in front of a crowd of strangers, microphone in hand, and croon or screech or bark or bellow your favorite song? If your first thought is a good stiff drink, you might be onto something. Since its explosion in the 1980s, karaoke has been a draw at bars around the world. But while most of us engage in this very public expression of music appreciation only sparingly, for others it quickly becomes a passion, if not an obsession. Entertainment writer Brian Raftery fell into that category for a while, which he explains in his new book, Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. Brian, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
So you look at karaoke as the ultimate expression of music appreciation. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I grew up as a really, like, you know, most kids, I started listening to music at a very young age, and I just fell in love with music, and I fell in love with the radio. And unfortunately, as I realized very early on in life, I was never going to be a singer. So I think, you know, a lot of people grow up with this sort of, you know, relationship with music that's almost kind of cruel, where it's like you love this thing so much, you love a song, you love an album, yet you don't ever get that full sort of satisfaction of singing in front of other people. I mean, a lot of people sing to themselves, they, you know, maybe join a cover band, but for me, like, karaoke became this way that every song that had been sort of knocking around my head the last couple of years or, you know, decades at a certain point, I could finally just sort of communicate with them, which sounds very strange, but when I love a song now, the first thing I think is, I can't wait to sing this at karaoke. I can't wait to kind of make the song my own in a way.
Well, it's really interesting because for eons of human existence, there were no rules about who got to sing and who didn't.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things I mentioned in the book is that I do think that at a certain point, once recorded music came along and we sort of had the pop star era, people started to look around and say, wait, this guy is on this level, he can sing, and I can't. And I think Americans got kind of a hang-up about whether you really are quote-unquote supposed to be singing. And yeah, but you, I mean, for years and years, it didn't matter. You sang with your family, you sang in church, you sang while you were working. You know, it was a very communal form of entertainment, and I think we sort of got a little bit too stressed out about whether we actually had the quote-unquote talent to sing for a while.
Well, it's also weird, and I think you're right that you discovered you couldn't sing when you were about 10, because all throughout people's childhoods, they're encouraged to sing regardless, and then suddenly there's that day when people start saying, oh, you should just keep your mouth shut.
Yeah, and I mean, mine was pretty bad from the get-go. I mean, I used to sort of like, I used to go out, because I was a little bit of a spaz when I was a kid, and you know, which is perfectly fine, but I did used to sing all the time, and I'd sort of go on the swing set and just sort of sing really loud, like really obnoxiously, you know, like Weird Al Yankovic songs or Beastie Boys songs. And I remember almost every time I finished, there were no other kids around. Everyone had taken off. So either they were terrified by the fact that I was screaming, but I think they were actually really put off from my voice. So I kind of got my earliest music reviews when I was 10 or 11, and it didn't get any better from there. It's actually kind of almost gotten worse now at this point.
So you have this tremendous lifelong love of singing and a commensurate lack of talent. What got you up on stage the first time?
It took a long time. I mean, I'd heard about karaoke when I was very young, and just sort of my father wound up going to a karaoke bar one night, which was amazing to me. I'd never even heard what that was. And my father, like such as myself, is not blessed with the greatest voice, so the idea that he would get up and sing was so strange to me. And then, you know, I sort of forgot about it for a long time because I was very young, and karaoke was only at bars throughout most of the 80s. You had to be 21. And eventually when I went to college, I met a friend who was a lot like me, was very much into music and singing, and we sort of drive around just like sing goofy songs and stuff. And he said, you know, you should try karaoke. And he had done it in Japan while he was there. And we went up one night, and I was absolutely terrified. And as you mentioned, it was more than just one stiff drink sort of helped me get on stage. But when it was over, I was like, wow, it was very liberating. It was like, wow, you know what? I've always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to sort of own a song in a way and just sort of sing it without any care of who was listening or whether I was doing it well. And it was kind of like a permission slip to go on stage without having to have any talent, which is what kind of got me to really start going to karaoke pretty frequently at that point.
You do point out in the book that one can get up on stage and do karaoke sober as long as the rest of the audience is drinking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've done karaoke sober a few times, and I sort of did it as an endurance test. I was like, well, how would it sound different? And, you know, I certainly am at the point now where I don't get rip-roaringly drunk, but I do find that one or two drinks generally sort of loosens up and dupes me into thinking that my voice is better. But it certainly helps if you know that everyone around you is not taking it that seriously either.
How tolerant are audience members of someone who sounds just awful?
You know, it's strange. I actually had an incident last night, which was the first time I ever saw people getting really visibly, audibly angry at a singer. And it was at a very small bar downtown in the East Village of Manhattan, and we were just with a small group, and we'd sort of been singing, and none of us were good singers. But then this other couple sort of across the room went into this really, truly horrific version of Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer. And it was like, it was hard to tell. We thought they were kind of being ironic at first, but it was actually just sort of, it seemed like they were kind of screaming at us. So that was the first time I saw the people sort of get slightly like, what's going on here? But for the most part, people are very supportive. I mean, I think everyone, you know, I think most people who are watching karaoke from the audience, they're getting ready to sing themselves. And they know that, you know, eventually, you know, that they're going to be on trial too in sort of a sense in a few minutes, or they already have been. So most people are pretty forgiving. But, you know, a lot of people sort of also vote with their feet and will sort of trickle out of a really bad karaoke bar. I've seen that happen. It's a little more passive aggressive.
We should stop here, by the way, and point out that not only do we sort of do karaoke in a different venue than the Japanese would, but we pronounce it all wrong.
We do, yeah. And my apologies to any Japanese language listeners who are listening and getting offended. It's karaoke. And the reason why I've actually sort of stuck with karaoke is because every time I pronounce it the Japanese way, people would think I was being incredibly pretentious, which for a karaoke fan is sort of a strange title. And also, you know, I just sort of felt like, well, you know, I'm never going to convince my one-man campaign to convince Americans to pronounce it correctly has clearly already failed. So I'm okay with karaoke. I actually like the word karaoke. I think it's got a nice, fun, sort of like loose rhythm to it, which kind of makes sense for the activity that it is.
It does seem like you'd drive people away if you said, my big hobby is karaoke.
Yeah, I know. It's sort of like, you know, the guy who's, you know, learned French for 1 year and then, you know, insists on pronouncing everything with a French accent.
Yeah, give me a croissant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So talk for a minute about what it's like to do karaoke in Japan.
It's wonderful. I mean, you know, it started there. It started there in the early 70s with the first karaoke machines, and they've sort of perfected it to the point where, you know, obviously you go to the big cities like Tokyo and Osaka, there is a karaoke bar on just about every other corner. I mean, it's sort of like the bodegas in New York City. They're just, you know, you can go two blocks and find one. But they're not very big on the sort of American karaoke or sort of Western karaoke of getting on a stage. They have these tiny rooms called K-boxes. And you walk into a building that's almost like an apartment building, except everyone's singing. And it's just lots of tiny little rooms, and you can go in there for hours. They've got little songs. They've got songbooks with, you know, tens of thousands of strange songs. And you get a remote control, and then, you know, every 10 minutes someone brings you a Suntory whiskey or a beer. And it's actually pretty great. I actually prefer the private room karaoke experience at this point.
And how many people tend to be in those little rooms?
Well, it depends if you go by what the limit is. I mean, They've gotten bigger, and the ones in New York, they've actually added some bigger rooms. But when I first started going to them in 1999, they were maybe, you know, 5 to 12 person capacity rooms, and there were definitely nights where we had twice whatever the occupancy was. They were very lax karaoke occupancy laws in New York at that point. They may have hammered down on that lately, but you will see people sort of flowing out. And in Japan, they have very elaborate ones. They actually sang in a hot tub once with a wireless microphone, which was the most
sounds
expensive.
Risky.
Yeah, it was. I was worried. I don't know what the wattage, you know, it's a other country. You're like, is now if I drop this in the water, it's Japan, so I'm sure they figured out how to not shock me. But it's like, if I go out singing a karaoke song in a hot tub in Japan, in one way it's a fitting demise, but at the other time it's going to be very explaining, hard for my parents to explain to people. But they love karaoke. It is such a fact of life there. It is a day-to-day thing. People do it after work. They do it after school. I mean, it's a normal thing there.
Well, and I know Americans have a lot of sort of generalizations about Japanese culture that may not be accurate, but one thing that a lot of people tend to imagine is that Japanese people would never want to sort of risk that and get up there and do something that feels so exposed.
Yeah, and I think the last two trips I've been to Japan, I've certainly seen a lot more people at karaoke of different ages in the public, in the K-box places. But I think, you know, the Japanese also have a tradition of learning, of discipline, and sort of proving that they have worked very hard on something. So there has always actually been a Japanese tradition where you will learn and sort of educate yourself and master one song, and you will sort of learn that song and recite it in front of friends. So, you know, instead of going to a karaoke bar and just picking what's on, you know, whatever you want to sing that night, you will go out and you will sing the one song very well in front of your boss or in front of your coworkers. And that's sort of what helped it for a while in the 80s in Japan, because they had all these businessmen who would go for meetings, and then you'd sort of sing your song to impress the boss. But I think the Japanese culture appears to become a lot more exhibitionist friendly in the last decade or so. I think that might be sort of a generational shift. But certainly I was surprised, you know, that I would go into restaurants in Japan where everything's very quiet and it's very reserved, and then you walk next door to a K-box place and people have, you know, tambourines and, you know, whistles and, you know, crazy sound effects. So I think it's a form of release in some way.
You say that the best karaoke song is sort of walks that fine line between too campy and too earnest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I always try to be very careful when I discuss my karaoke song preferences, because I try not to be a karaoke snob. It's almost as bad as pronouncing it in the strict Japanese way. But you know, I find the songs that are kind of the lesser known hits are always the most fun, and I think there are certain songs that are absolutely ridiculous and not actually, you know, songs you would never actually want to hear on the radio, that for some reason at karaoke, when you're singing along, sort of has this kind of sort of ridiculous, goofy genius to it. And one of those is this song called On Our Own by Bobby Brown, which a lot of people don't remember the name, but if you tell them it's the song from Ghostbusters 2 in which Bobby Brown raps, they'll go, oh my gosh, and actually last night we put it on and everyone in the bar knew it, even though they had no idea what it was when the title came on. So those kind of songs, and you know, there are a lot of people who do very ironic karaoke, and I'm not a big fan of that. I'm not a big fan of people going up there and sort of making fun of it as they do it, or you know, doing it intentionally bad. But you know, I think if you take it somewhere straight down the middle, you're not too serious, you're not making fun of it. As long as you really love the song you're singing, and people can see that passion, that's what makes a good karaoke performance, regardless of whether or not you can sing.
And we happen to have your favorite song loaded up. Will you give us a little 15 seconds about why you love Sister Christian?
To me, it's always been the penultimate karaoke song for a couple reasons. Everyone knows the chorus when it comes on. Everyone loves singing along, and it's one big, simple word where they just say motorin' over and over again. And so for me, I've never had a sedate Sister Christian experience. Even on a bad karaoke night, Sister Christian will always get people singing.
Sister Christian, oh, the time has come, and you know that you're the only one to say, okay. Where you go and what you looking for, you know those boys don't wanna play no more with you, it's true.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Do You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is entertainment writer Brian Raftery. His new book is called Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. If you want to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, of course, we went out on Sister Christian for anyone who turned on the radio in fear that KERA had changed formats. You actually talked to the Night Ranger guy who wrote the song.
I did. I mean, halfway through, I was trying to think of, you know, I really had to come down on what is my favorite karaoke song, because I knew I'd been asked for years, and I kind of kept changing the answer. So I was like, you know what, I'm going to come out and say, stay firm with Sister Christian. So I called him and sort of asked him, you know, if he was aware of how, you know, popular Sister Christian is at karaoke, and he wasn't, but he did tell me that, you know, they actually play that song in Japan, and they actually almost can stop playing because the entire crowd of Japanese listeners actually will sing along. So it was interesting to me that, like, he'd sort of written the song that so many people had, you know, put so much heart into singing along this anthem and this chorus, and he was like, yeah, you know, I took the word motor, and it just came to me one day, and I was like, wow, it's really, you have no idea how that one simple decision has affected so many lives.
So talk about how this all came to be, because there was this guy who noticed in the early 70s that people liked to go to bars where there was a piano player or somebody that would accompany them if they got up and sang.
Yeah, he was actually a jazz drummer named Daisuke Inoue, and he was in Osaka, and he wasn't a very good drummer. He kind of found out the hard way that the competitive sort of drumming scene in the city at that time, everyone told him that he should be doing something behind the scenes. So he went out and realized, you know, saw that people like to sing in these bars, and he figured that if he could make a machine where you could sing along with, you wouldn't have to pay the actual musicians, which, you know, was not good news for the musicians, but... So he sort of went home and drew up the plans for this little tiny box called the Juke 8. It's about the size of a milk crate, and it had, you know, it played 8 tracks, it took a coin, and it had a microphone. So he sort of mashed all these technologies together and started bringing it around the small Japanese cities, and it took a while, and he had to actually sort of sometimes hire hostesses to go in and sort of convince these drunken Japanese businessmen to go sing. But after a while, it really took off, and it became this big company, but he never patented the machine, so he never made this karaoke fortune that people think he has.
That's sort of sad. And then technology obviously made it easier and easier for good-sounding tracks to be on there. How is the music... I had always assumed that it was just the actual tracks, and then somehow they would remove the vocals, but these things are usually recorded by themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think to actually get the, you know, actual master recording would be very, very expensive. There's a couple of different ways. I mean, there's very quick, sort of down and dirty sort of companies that will take just sort of program the music into a very cheap little keyboard, and just sort of it'll spit out this very kind of goofy sounding, almost Nintendo sort of like song. But there is this really great company in North Carolina called Sound Choice, which I'd always sort of seen their logo, and every time it came up, I was like, wow, their songs always sound so good. And they actually had for years this house band where they would go in. They had a team of musicians who would listen to old, you know, whether it was an old song like the Stones song or a new song, and they would figure out the exact amplifier they used, and they would recreate it perfectly. And it sounds weird to care about what the karaoke backing track is like, but so much of it is sort of convincing yourself in the moment that you are that singer. And if it actually sounds like you're singing a really, you know, the actual version of the song, it's much more empowering. When you go up with kind of a really dinky little... that little keyboard sound while you're trying to sing, it makes it a little more, it makes it sort of less exciting.
So how much is it about the rock star fantasy?
I think it's a big part of it. I mean, I think certainly in the last couple of years, it's no longer a rock star fantasy as much as it is an American Idol fantasy, where I think people sort of now think, wow, you know, not only, I think, you know, people used to think, well, I could, you know, get in a band and sing and work real hard, and now it's like, well, I think I could go to karaoke, learn how to sing, and get on a big TV show and sort of, you know, bypass a lot of the other, you know, show business sort of machinations. But, I mean, I think, you know, look, getting on stage and singing a really big anthemic song, I mean, there's a lot of levels of satisfaction, but the biggest level is sort of feeling this very brief feeling that you've only observed, which is the sheer, you know, euphoria of hitting this really great chorus and having other people either sing along with you or rooting for you, which is an indescribable physical high.
The most amazing thing I think about American Idol is not that eventually the cream rises to the top, but all the people that in good faith go and audition for that show, and then you see the outtakes, and they really have no business anywhere but a karaoke bar.
Yeah, I know, and it's weird. I have this very sort of tortured relationship with American Idol, where I love the first season so much that once they started the second season by showing all the kind of castaways and kind of like cruelly making fun of them, I thought I actually sort of stopped watching at that point, only checked in. But yeah, I mean, you know, there is a lot of talent that should be relegated to the karaoke bars. But at the same time, I've covered some of these international karaoke competitions, and there are a lot of really good amateur singers who maybe don't deserve to be amateurs. You know, I mean, they've got great voices, and they've honed them at home while using karaoke. And, you know, it's just so hard to break into the industry, but a lot of them, there are still some really great karaoke singers out there. It's not all just kind of goofy, you know, atonal goofs like myself.
Is there a hope? Is there hope for a lot of them to sort of move up to the next echelon?
I think there's more now than there was 5 years ago. But you know, there's a lot of resentment toward American Idol in the karaoke industry because a lot of the singers are, you know, in their early 30s. A lot of them are, you know, have been singing for a long time, and they finally sort of really started to get these at-home machines. They can practice better, and there's an age cutoff for American Idol. So I think a lot of people feel like there is, you know, there's this venue now that you could use karaoke to become famous, but unfortunately, it's only for a small segment of the population.
We have an email from Jeannie in Fort Worth who says, have you seen the large-scale multimedia art by Phil Collins, not the musician, but the artist from Britain who focuses on karaoke?
No, I haven't, actually. I've heard about it. I actually have not seen that.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, and it sort of incorporates a lot of the things that you're talking about, people that are very passionately out there singing, whether they sound good or not.
Yeah, I've still got to see that. I've heard about it a lot, so I definitely want to check that out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. My guest is entertainment writer Brian Raftery. His new book is called Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. Can you tell before somebody gets up what sort of karaoke singer they will be?
No, which is one of the most fun things about karaoke for me, especially if it's someone I know fairly well and I think I have figured out and I've already kind of stereotyped, okay, this person's going to do a country song, this person's going to do, you know, some like an old Stone song. You can never tell, which I think is one of the most fun aspects where you see people sort of release into this sort of, you know, I don't want to say alter ego, but people discover a certain persona, I think, all of a sudden when there's a microphone in their hand and they realize that they're on. And, you know, I've always enjoyed the fact that I will go out to karaoke with complete strangers and they will put on some song that, you know, I would never expect them to, or they will break into like some really amazing section of a hip-hop song and really be able to rap like really, really well. So I'm always surprised. I rarely have ever, I've never ever actually accurately stereotyped anyone at karaoke, which is probably for the best.
And there are some songs that work really well when you're playing them at home, and they're just terrible karaoke songs. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, my own experience has always been that the sort of most beloved big classic rock songs, like, you know, like Stairway to Heaven and Freebird, these songs that always top the classic rock polls and that are playing the radio and people always sing along with, they're great to sing along with in the car, because no one's there watching you during the guitar solo parts. So a good karaoke song really needs to have absolutely the minimal amount of guitar that you can, because otherwise you're just standing there, which is kind of fun for a few seconds, but 40 seconds of just standing in the middle of the stage in front of people when you're already kind of nervous can be kind of terrifying. So I've always found that the longer classic rock songs, which I love, are just always abysmal karaoke.
Well, how much is physical presence a part of what you're doing when you're up there?
I think it depends. I think in the K-Box rooms, if you go in the private rooms, you're kind of crowded together, and it almost always inevitably sort of becomes a dance party, which because everyone's sort of involved and they pass the mic around, everyone's kind of moving, which is really fun. But when you're on, you know, at a karaoke bar on stage, I've seen very few people really know the sort of breathing techniques. I mean, I certainly don't. I've had to dance and how to sing at the same time. I actually met a guy when I was doing researching the book, and I was in Bangkok, and this guy was an amazing singer, and he danced like I'd never seen any karaoke singer because he had trained himself. So he kept winning all these performances because he could really move physically, and it really does change the performance. I mean, if you can do a couple of really cool, quick little hand gestures or sort of get the crowd going, it does sort of increase the momentum of the show.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Holly in Dallas. Hi, Holly.
Hi, I have a question. You were talking a second ago about American Idol and people taking karaoke really serious, and I've definitely witnessed people like that, and I find their performances really cumbersome. Do you prefer people that take it serious, or just like those bad singers that kind of have, kind of can just provide a bit of a comic relief and entertainment? And that's my question. I'll take the answer off there.
Yeah, I think I kind of like it somewhere in the middle. I've also been at places where someone who is a really good singer wants everyone to sort of quiet down and pay attention to them. And as much respect I have for their ability, it does get kind of boring, actually, as an audience member. And also, a lot of the people who are really good singers generally sort of pick from, like, the same sort of 25 songs or so. And I've been to some of these competitions where I've heard, you know, My Heart Will Go On, you know, 6-7 times a night, which is kind of a terrifying situation.
Yeah, the original's bad enough.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's you sort of hear these 5 or 6, you know, songs that everyone wants to sort of sing to show off. But I really do think that, you know, my only criteria is, as long as you can tell the person is really into the actual song and is really in the moment, if they're not there to show off, if they're not there to make their friends just laugh, if they actually are like, you know what, I love this song, let me just express it in this way, it doesn't really matter if they're that great or that terrible. For me, it's like it's all about sort of seeing what the person's like on stage and how much they relate to that song. But I definitely have been in situations where I'm like, this person's a great singer and I cannot wait until they're finished.
Do you ever try to talk people into trying karaoke, or is it something that they have to come to on their own?
I used to. I mean, when I first started doing it about 10 years ago, my friends and I just had the hardest time getting anyone to come to karaoke with us, even in these private rooms. I mean, it was just like, you know, they would look at us like we were crazy. And it's gotten much, much easier in the last couple of years. I mean, I don't think I have more than 1 or 2 friends who don't enjoy karaoke, and that might be some sort of inadvertent Darwinism on my part, where I've weeded out the weaker ones.
You're only friends with karaoke
people. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think a lot of people become a lot more open to it. And I think, you know, it's a test, you know, you can sort of tell the testament to how popular it is now that it's, you know, it's in every city. No matter what city I go to, there is a karaoke night going on somewhere. So I think people are a lot less, resistant to doing it as they used to be.
Let's speak next to Andrew in Dallas. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thanks.
I actually just wanted to ask if you had ever been to any dueling piano bars. It's not exactly the same as karaoke. It's actually, you know, professional musicians performing the songs. But me and a lot of my friends have gone, and we just find it to be so much fun. There, a lot of times the slogan is, if you can't sing good, sing loud. And they try to get the audience participation going. It's a lot of fun, and I was just curious if you could comment on that, and
I've
I'll
never
take
actually,
my comments off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, I've never actually been to one. I mean, it sounds great, and it sounds like it's kind of the same spirit of the sort of, you know, very exhibitionist form of music appreciation, and it also sounds like a really good time, but I've actually never been to a dueling piano bar. I'd love to go, though.
Are there particularly good group karaoke songs?
I find that generally sort of duets tend to do very well. Songs that have, for example, one of the most popular karaoke songs, even though I'm kind of a little burnt out on it, is anything from Grease that's a duet tends to get, you always hear coming from private rooms. You'll hear a big group of people singing that. A lot of the group songs that are really popular tend to be a lot of the same songs that are popular at weddings, you know, a lot of Dancing Queen. But I find songs, you know, you get a lot of songs with good backing vocals, like, you know, Like a Virgin or something, or I'm sorry, Like a Prayer. You know, anything that lets people sort of chime in when they want to and sort of drop back if they're a little uncomfortable, that makes for a good group karaoke song.
We have an email from Bill in Dallas who writes, I suspect certain songs, because of the extreme personal nature of their lyrics, would be poor choices for karaoke. For example, God by John Lennon and Nobody Home by Pink Floyd. Have you ever witnessed someone trying something this personal, and did you cringe?
Well, thankfully they don't have those. I've never seen those two songs at karaoke. those would be kind of terrible. I think I've less seen more songs that have, you know, I think I've seen more songs that people don't realize might be a little too early in the night for. I think a lot of people think that Sir Mix-a-Lot's Baby Got Back is always, a good thing to sing and might not always be as discomforting as it is, but there's actually times where that song has come on and it's like, you know what, it's too early. We can't go blue yet in the room. It's only like 8 o'clock. It's not time to bust out the slightly more double entendre-laden hip-hop songs. But I've never seen a song go over with any sort of like weird sort of lyrics, except for We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel.
Oh, sure. Basically, he just chants a bunch of things throughout the whole song.
Yeah, then you realize you're sort of like, there's a lot of weird references in there. It's like you're basically doing a sort of bad rap song with mentions of Vietnam War and Korea, and you're like, this is not actually a very uplifting number whatsoever.
And the title of your book, Don't Stop Believing, obviously is from the Journey song. Is that a particularly good one, or is that on your list of top songs?
That would have been years ago. I mean, the weird thing about having that book is the title is we chose it because, you know, obviously it's a very popular song, and it's an insanely popular karaoke song, even more so now after the Sopranos sort of involvement. But for me, it's actually become the song that I became so sick of at karaoke about 5 years ago, even though 10 years ago I loved it. But unfortunately, it was like one of those things where I was like, you know, there's Journey songs that I like better, but Lovin', Touchin', Squeezin' is not exactly a good book title for a book about karaoke. Nor is Wheel in the Sky. It wouldn't have made any sense. So I'm happy with Don't Stop Believin'. In fact, the karaoke bar I went to last night had a post listed up its top 100 song requests of 2008, and Don't Stop Believin' was number 2, which was really amazing. I can't believe how popular it's become, even more so with young kids after The Sopranos.
Oh, sure. Well, but I have to imagine you might have had it placed in the book placed in the wrong section of the bookstore.
Yes, probably. Yeah, exactly.
And are there artists that their range is just too far away from yours and you wouldn't even get close to them?
You know, I think I've seen people try to do a ha-ha funny of, you know, Minnie Riperton's Loving You, which is so high-pitched and, you know, it's this helium voice sort of thing that's not, I don't think, humanly attainable, nor is it, you know, particularly fun to listen to even as a joke. I like Prince a lot. Prince is probably one of my favorite recording artist ever, I'd say, one of the top three. And there are a lot of songs like he does this high falsetto yelp that I can't come anywhere near to. But still, the songs are so good that you don't really care if you don't hit the notes.
Yeah, are you braver as the night goes on?
Absolutely. I mean, braver and also slightly more, slightly a little more inebriated too, which certainly kind of goes hand in hand. But I think once you get the feel of the place and you get the feel of the room and you're with friends, as the night goes on, you sort of start to care less and less about how you're coming off in front of others.
Brian Raftery is my guest. He is an entertainment writer. His new book is called Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. We'll be back in a minute, and you're welcome to join us by phone at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer Brian Raftery, whose new book is called Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Given that this is, Brian, a sort of subculture, can you talk about the most important rules of karaoke etiquette?
Well, I think the most important one, as we were kind of discussing earlier, is that it's very poor form to boo or to sort of get into really rowdy and put someone's performance down. I think that's always kind of that's always the main rule. I think also, you know, I think it's very important not to be a mic hog. I've been to a couple places where, you know, karaoke jockeys, as they're called, or KJs, a lot of them are really great. There are a couple that are very susceptible to bribes, as I've seen, and I've actually seen people kind of like bribe their way to the top of the queue many times over and over again, which I always think is that's kind of in poor form. And I think those are the most important rules. And you know, I think also, you know, as again, like the sort of ironic making fun of karaoke as you do it and kind of like stopping halfway through and being like, I'm not doing this anymore. You've got to go all the way through. I mean, I've seen people walk off and it's very awkward to see because, you know, you pick the song, you're supposed to get up and sing it, and you don't have to do it well, but at least, you know, at least have the, you know, the faith to go all the way through. So those are some of the more important rules. But, I you know, it's also kind of a lawless subculture in a lot of ways, so which is kind of fun.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Arlington next and speak with Bill. Hey, Bill.
Oh, hi there. It's interesting listening to your guest. I can't sing worth a lick, but I've times I've been in a karaoke situation, I enjoy listening to other folks. It seems that most of the singers are in the higher tones, like sopranos or whatever. But one time, a while back, I was in a bar, and there was a man who sang in a baritone voice, and he did an old ballad called O Shenandoah, which is not really a karaoke bar type of song, but it was really pretty good. And I was wondering if your guest has encountered slower, lower-voiced men like that. It's kind of a break from the normal action.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I've actually I've heard Old Man River, weirdly, a couple times in a very deep baritone. And I find also that in some bars that you go to, there's a couple in L.A. that are frequented by older men. I mean, it seems to be like it draws a much older crowd than some of the ones in Manhattan or in Brooklyn. And you do hear a lot of sort of like baritone or low, you know, sort of lower, very slowed down and very really wonderful renditions of, you know, old standards or Sinatra songs, which is pretty great. I haven't heard O Shenandoah, though, at karaoke. That'd be kind of amazing.
How are the songs that are added every year to the list that's available, how are they chosen by the people who record these things?
I think what they look for, and it's been changing a lot. The karaoke industry is changing a while. They've had some problems with piracy. So a lot of the bigger companies have been shuttering lately for a lot of complicated, not super exciting legal copyright issues. But I think what they look for is they have to sort of look at what the song is going to be a year from now. I mean, you know, a hit song, the song is number one right now. Does it have legs? Will people be singing this in 2 years? And so they use the phrase evergreen. Is it an evergreen song? You know, no matter if we spend the money to record this song now, will we still be making money off it in 10, 15 years? So it's a bit of a gamble, and it's kind of interesting. I mean, one of the guys I spoke to, his whole job was to analyze every music chart, MTV, MySpace, every single form of metric for music, and sort of predict what would still be happening 4 months down the line, a year down the line.
Wow. And once you, if you own a karaoke setup, do you subscribe to these songs, and do you pay like an ASCAP BMI fee?
All the publishing fees are paid for, I think, by the company that records it. And there are also various rules for certain bars that play music during the year that have to pay a certain amount of money to, I think, ASCAP and BMI. But for the most part, I think the owners themselves, it seems at least in New York, what they do is they basically just buy these British-made compilations that come out every month and just add them to their queue, because they'll suddenly add 75 songs or something one day, and 50 of them will be songs, okay, I know this, and then 25 will be some really bizarre, like, you know, boy band group from Wales. You're like, who is this? Like, I've never, it's like a strange, like, not the good Euro pop that crosses over. It's like, you know, it's like Take That or something like that, like a, you know, a remake or something. There never seems to be any sort of real logic as to what songs are added to a karaoke bar. It's always like you show up one day and it's like the rules have changed all of a sudden without any sort of explanation why.
Brian Raftery is the author of Don't Stop Believin'. Let's go next to Tim in Denton. Hey, Tim.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi. My experience with karaoke is limited exclusively to the K-boxes in Japan. I was a high school exchange student there. And one of the big favorites for me and my group of friends were Disney songs. And it was kind of strange to have this group of high school kids singing Disney songs, but it really worked really well, and I was wondering if you've seen that in the more open exhibitionist settings of the American style bars.
I've seen I've certainly seen people do a lot of Broadway songs, and I think that's kind of like I'm seeing more and more of those additions to songbooks in America. I mean, the thing that's so amazing, you know, as you know, going to those K-boxes, the song selections in Japan are truly astonishing. I mean, it's like they have Western songs that we don't have in America, and it's very, very strange. I mean, you can go to a K-box there, and you'll find old standards. You'll find, like, bizarre pop punk songs. You'll find, like, so many Carpenter songs that you haven't even heard of them. So I think, you know, one of the great things about Japanese karaoke was for a long time, they were the place you went to for a lot of song diversity, where you could do whatever you wanted to. And Americans now, I think now there's more karaoke bars and there's more competition, the American karaoke bars are getting a little more, you know, competitive with their song selection as well.
Why is it, and maybe we should say it's a good thing because the original is so good that we don't want it duplicated, but why is it that a song like Desperado is on no karaoke menu ever?
Well, there are versions of Desperado, but a lot of them are possibly illegal. Don Henley is sort of famous within the karaoke industry. He rankles a lot of people because the Eagles traditionally never allow their songs to be licensed for anything. And I think they're in a Guitar Hero now, which is amazing to me. So a lot of times the Eagles have pretty much declined permission for people to record karaoke songs. However, there is a rather sizable karaoke piracy community that's run a lot of out of, not in the U.S. so much, but coming to the U.S. from other countries. So it is possible if you have performed Desperado or another, you know, Don Henley-written karaoke song, you may have been, you know, supporting some sort of karaoke piracy ring without knowing it. But, you know, this is why Henley is so disliked, because the people who legally record songs say, hey, you won't let us record this song, but this guy here is doing it legally, and therefore, you know, we're the legit company and we're missing out. So I think also they just pick on Don Henley because Don Henley is kind of fun to pick on.
Let's go next to Chris in Fort Worth. Hello, Chris.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great, thanks.
I was going to say, a friend of mine hosts a karaoke night in Chicago where they use a live house band that has a huge catalog of songs under their belt, I guess to add that excitement of a live band, and it's become really popular. In fact, Paul Stanley of Kiss called up there one afternoon wanting to do four songs that weren't Kiss songs. I was wondering if this is something that's becoming popular elsewhere, because it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it has. It started, from what I could tell when I'm researching it, it started with this punk rock karaoke band in L.A., which was made up of former members of a lot of really big sort of independent punk bands. And what happened was they would play a couple of gigs, and at one of their gigs, a guy from New York saw them and decided to start it in New York. So in 1999, this band called the Punk Karaoke Band started playing in New York on a monthly basis, and it became a big deal, so much so that they wound up expanding their song list to include heavy metal and including corporate rock, which is, you know, Journey and Styx. And since then, I mean, it's really taken off everywhere. Actually, the band in Chicago is pretty, one of them is pretty famous, because I think one of them plays at a bar that Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick owns, so they have a big following. And I mean, live band karaoke, I think, is really kind of the future of karaoke at this point, because it takes the whole involve yourself with the music one step further, and it really immerses you even further in the rock star sort of illusion of karaoke.
Well, you can go to, you know, Target or Walmart or whatever and buy these home karaoke machines now, and some of them run through your TV and some of them have a little speaker. Have you tried that, and does that really take something away from it? Do you need a crowd for this to be any fun?
I actually have a home setup. I actually went for the old vintage 80s laser discs because I really like a lot of those ridiculous karaoke videos, and I kind of wanted to have a little museum of them. But I've done it a couple times just myself and my wife, which is really fun. But whenever we've done it at home, we have had big groups. So at least it's like, it's more of like a party than it is sort of like a way to go on stage and kind of show off in front of strangers. It's a little more intimate. I think it's moving a lot more toward that. I think a lot of entertainment now is becoming, you know, more at home, more sort of with a small group of people. But I think it can be just as fun. And also, you know, obviously when you have five friends, that means you get to go up every five times, which is a pretty good amount of karaoke songs in a night.
Let's go next to Joe in Cleburne. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks.
I just wanted to share my worst karaoke disaster story with you. It was 1989, and I was living in Shingu, Japan, which is a small town in Wakayama-ken. At this point, they did not have a very wide selection of karaoke songs in English. And I was invited out to karaoke with an older crowd one night. We went to a karaoke bar that was more geared towards the over 50 crowd. And the only Western songs they had were Frank Sinatra, and they talked me into singing My Way. And at this point in my life, I had never even really heard any Frank Sinatra songs. And I can tell people from experience, if you're going to try and sing karaoke, you should at least be somewhat familiar with the song you sing before you try and sing it, because not only did I go over like a lead balloon, but I was never asked to sing karaoke with that particular group of people again.
Sage advice. Thank you for sharing that story, Joe. How often do you see, Brian, people who get up there and they sort of think they know the song better than they do?
It happens once in a while, and that's kind of what leads to what I was talking about earlier with people getting visibly frustrated and kind of walking out. I think especially if you're really nervous, you look at the song list and you start singing the song in your head, and you go through the first verse, and you go, oh, okay, I know this. I know how it goes. And then all of a sudden this chorus comes up, and you know the words are flashing in front of you, and you maybe don't pick up that the music's changing, and it all of a sudden you can get very lost, and it becomes kind of an awkward, you know, do you just sort of make something up, or do you sort of talk over and try to make a joke? I've generally just sort of faked my way through it if I forget, which is just sort of like make a sort of slightly melodic kind of noise, and I don't know, sort of look around and kind of, you know, but I try to at least know, you know, 75% of the song if I'm gonna try to do it.
Let's go next to Kevin in Dallas. Hi, Kevin.
Yes. Hey, how you doing? I'm half Japanese. The first time I went to karaoke was in Japan. My cousin took me, and one of the things has to do with karaoke etiquette. One thing that I was taught was that whenever there's the instrumental part of the song, that's when the audience claps for that person. And it works out good for me and my friends whenever we go, because, you know, we start clapping for the person who's singing, and then that gets the rest of the bar clapping for that person too. And the DJ really appreciates it. I know the person singing it really appreciates it. So I just wanted to add that little piece of etiquette. Thank you.
Oh, great to know. Thanks.
That is great. Actually, that happened to me a couple of times in Japan, and I had no idea why people were clapping. No one explained it to me, so I thought I was doing especially well. And then the instrumental break came on. I was like, oh, I guess I'm really bringing Phil Collins tonight. But that's actually a great idea. I mean, I wonder if we could get that started in America, because it would certainly make for a lot less mid-song awkwardness.
Do you think this will endure forever, or is this sort of I guess it can't be a flash in the pan if it's been 35 years.
Yeah, I really do. I mean, I think it's going to change forms. I do think we're going to see more stuff like live band karaoke. I think we're going to see a bigger movement toward the more private rooms and people doing it at home, just because, you know, you can get more customers nowadays doing that. You know, it's very appealing for, like, birthday parties and so those sort of events. But I don't think it's going away. I mean, I think actually, you know, we were so late to the party as Americans with karaoke that we're actually probably going to be kind of hitting our peak right now, whereas other countries were sort of, you know, peaking out in the mid-90s or so. This is a country that loves music, and even though they don't always buy it anymore, they just sort of download it. But they love to sing, and a lot of people really do sort of have, you know, certain performance drives that they want to get out in public. So I don't think it'll ever go away.
Can you actually download karaoke tunes, like, on iTunes?
They have karaoke. There are, like, karaoke iPod-compatible tunes. I haven't played with a lot of those, but there's a large online karaoke community. I mean, there's a MySpace karaoke, which has a lot of people. And what people do, what seems to be really popular from what I've observed, is you record yourself singing, and it goes up, you know, on these boards, and people vote it up or down or give you comments, which a lot of people really, really love. For me, that's not as much fun, because I know what kind of reviews I'm going to get, and because I'd rather just sort of sing along with my friends. But there's a big appeal right now for that sort of performance outlet.
And in the last 10 seconds, your favorite karaoke song that has never been recorded for you to sing, who's the artist that you wish were available in karaoke?
I think it will always be I Can Never Take the Place of Your Man by Prince, which is my favorite Prince song, one of his best songs he ever did, and I'll never be able to find that at karaoke.
We'll hope that somebody will pirate it for you. Brian Raftery's new book is called Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. Brian, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.